To hear argument, you ready to proceed?
Good afternoon, Your Honor.
Steve Norman for Potter, Anderson, Caroon for the appellant, NAMA Holdings, LLC. I'd like to introduce Ron Cohen from the Sibley & Austin firm. He's been admitted pro lock place in this court, and he's going to make the argument this morning.
Welcome to the court. And when I turn on the clock, it'll show you have 20 minutes, and it'll count down.
Okay.
When the yellow light comes on, you're into the time you've reserved.
Okay. I reserved 5 minutes. Thank you. May it please the court, this case concerns a contractual books and records provision. The trial court's decision hinges on an interpretation of that provision that no party ever suggested, not before the trial, not during the trial, not after the trial in the post-trial briefing. Seizing on words in Section 1218E of the Books and Records provision, the words reasonable access, the court determined that those words alone gave the managers of Venture discretion and power to withhold documents from NAMA or to condition its inspection to such an extent that the inspection would be meaningless. Nothing in the record suggests that any party ever interpreted the term reasonable access in Section 1218E to have that meaning. Venture never argued it, and it was a surprise to everyone. 1218E of the agreement provides that NAMA shall have access on the same terms, the same manner, and to the same extent as the members of Venture. There is no question that the members of Venture have unconditional and absolute right to the documents listed in 9.1 of the agreement. And if NAMA is to have access on the same terms and under the same conditions as the members, then NAMA is also entitled to unconditional rights to those same documents. So our position is as simple as that.
Is it your position that the record reflects under no circumstances could any of the members ever been requested to sign a confidentiality agreement?
That's right. Under the literal reading of the contract, and this was a heavily negotiated contract, the members have the right, and it's unconditional, to inspect and copy the books and records listed in 9.1. The only caveat being it needs to be during business hours. That's the only condition. Had the parties intended to have confidentiality provisions attach to that inspection right, they could have added that.
Yeah. Before we talk about these parties and this contract, since these parties and this contract incorporated the members' right by reference, my question is it absolutely clear that if someone would have said to a member, you need to sign a confidentiality agreement, the member would have an absolute right to say no?
Yes, under the agreement, that is absolutely true. That condition is nowhere in the agreement. It could easily have been put in the agreement, and it wasn't. Now, bear in mind, I think it's important to bear in mind, members would have their own fiduciary duties with respect to information they receive. NAMA also has its own fiduciary duties with respect to information it receives. So it's not as if there's no duty to maintain confidences that would harm the company. That already exists as you know, just a matter of law in arising out of their relationships.
And is it your view that those fiduciary duties are coextensive?
Probably not. I mean, I think NAMA as a third-party beneficiary under this agreement, its fiduciary duties may have some differences between that and members. We would need to examine that on a case-by-case basis, depending on what sorts of information we were talking about. I think it's hard to make a general statement. But I think it's fair to say that, and NAMA acknowledged up front, we have fiduciary duties and we recognize we have fiduciary duties. But what we don't have is a contract that provides a condition, number one, a condition that allows them to impose confidentiality restrictions, and number two, a contract that allows them to impose such conditions that the inspection itself becomes meaningless. And recall here that the confidentiality provisions that were suggested or rather demanded by Venture did such things as require the return of all documents and notes at any time, require that there be no copies. That sort of thing rendered the inspection itself meaningless, and there's no support for that anywhere in the contract for conditioning NAMA's inspection rights on those sorts of conditions that essentially undermine the inspection entirely.
So is it your position that unreasonable access would not address a situation where your client wants to bring all the competitors in from High Point to see all the documents over their shoulder while they're looking at them?
Well, I think that would violate in itself fiduciary duties that NAMA would have to the company. So I don't think unconditional access means NAMA's unconditional access. It doesn't mean NAMA has the unconditional right to share it with anybody in the world. No question about that. In fact, the confidentiality agreement that NAMA proposed, which the trial court completely ignored in its decision, acting as if NAMA had never been willing to negotiate a confidentiality agreement, the record's undisputed. NAMA did propose a confidentiality agreement, and that confidentiality agreement had all those sorts of restrictions in it. The only use NAMA could make under its confidentiality agreement is what you would expect for its business and to the extent necessary to pursue an action, a litigation or an arbitration arising out of this business. It did not purport, NAMA never purported, to have the right to share the information with anybody it pleased, and moreover was willing to enter into a confidentiality agreement that would have explicitly, if it wasn't already implicit in NAMA's duties, explicitly prevented them from doing that.
So the scenario that I posited would not be unreasonable access as the parties intended, from your view. Although it may be precluded by something else, it's not unreasonable access.
I guess I'm not understanding the question entirely, Your Honor. Reasonable access, as we interpret it, means access applies to the time and manner, business hours, an appropriate place to do the inspection, and that's all. Otherwise, NAMA has the right to inspect on the same terms and conditions as members, and members have no other conditions attached to their inspection. They are explicitly allowed to view all these documents without condition, and they are explicitly allowed to copy them. And NAMA's right should be coextensive with that. If NAMA was willing, aside from recognizing the fiduciary duties that would prevent further disclosure, was willing to enter, even though the agreement didn't require it, was willing to enter into a confidentiality agreement that would have made its limited disclosure explicit. The difference between the agreement that NAMA proposed, which is the sort of fair and balanced and even-handed provision of, you know, in a form that the courts of this state have routinely used, the difference between that provision and the provision that was demanded by Venture and for the most part adopted by the trial court, is that that one essentially eviscerated the inspection right entirely by requiring that all copies be returned at a whim, under no standard at all, at any time, all notes be destroyed, rendering essentially all the work product that would be used and any information gained meaningless. And
could I interrupt you? Because it appears that the trial court made a conflicting finding of fact, conflicting with what you're saying. At page 8, the court refers to the proposed confidentiality agreement provided that was offered for NAMA, and then says NAMA made no effort to negotiate these terms and instead flatly rejected the basic concept of a confidentiality agreement. Is that just...
That's just wrong.
It's just wrong.
It's
There's
just
no
wrong.
Record support for that.
Right. What happened is...
It
and I think what
trial transcript 123.
What the court is referring to is that in the fall of 2006, shortly after the demand was made, after initially not requiring any confidentiality at all, a confidentiality agreement at the last minute was put on the table, was by Venture, as a condition of NAMA even showing up and seeing anything. That was put on the table as a take-it-or-leave-it offer. It was put on the table again as a take-it-or-leave-it offer in January. The litigation was then filed in February, and shortly after that, NAMA put up its own confidentiality agreement, which is in the record, and let me just find that for you. It's at 566. is the cover letter that went with it, and following that at 579 is the agreement itself. NAMA put that agreement on the table. It was during the litigation, to be sure, but nevertheless, before a decision, and made clear that NAMA was in fact willing to negotiate over a confidentiality agreement, and that confidentiality agreement is in a form routinely used by these courts.
All right, so
Venture never responded to that.
Let me be sure I understand your position. Are you looking at this confidentiality agreement that you proposed as a settlement offer that's really irrelevant to your position on appeal? Because as I understand your position on appeal, your reasonable access should never require you to execute a confidentiality agreement under any circumstances. That's your primary position.
That is, yes, it is. And that is the way the contract reads. It's clear it reads that way. There's no reference to confidentiality anywhere in the agreement. That is a strict construction of the agreement, which we do agree, which we do put forward as our first position. But nevertheless, recognizing that it is common practice in this state for confidentiality agreements to be used, and recognizing that NAMA had no problem with maintaining confidentiality. That was never been an issue. NAMA put forward a confidentiality agreement that should have ended that inquiry and concern entirely. If there was any legitimate concern,
well,
that should have
handled it. Going back to the opinion, and let's characterize it as an alternative position on your part. If we conclude that the Vice Chancellor was correct in construing reasonable access to permit a confidentiality agreement, your alternative position would be yours should have been acceptable.
Right. Ours should have been acceptable because ours was even-handed. Ours permitted the inspection to go forward in a meaningful way. And the, in contrast, the agreement that was put forward by Venture and largely adopted by the trial court essentially eviscerated the inspection right entirely. And to the extent that there were legitimate concerns about confidentiality, those are entirely addressed in the agreement we put forward. The extent that there are other concerns out there that are not legitimate, you know, essentially what the agreement that is in the judgment and was proposed by Venture does is deal with some confidentiality concerns by essentially just wiping out the inspection right entirely. And the courts of this state have said that's not the way that inspection should proceed. Irrespective of when you have a contract that doesn't have any confidentiality provision at all. In an ordinary inspection case, if there are concerns about confidentiality, those should be dealt with a confidentiality agreement, a reasonable one, not dealt with as was dealt with here by essentially wiping out the inspection right entirely. This was an inspection right that the parties had bargained for. NAMA had bargained for transparency in this transaction in exchange for giving up substantial controls over the project, and that transparency has been completely wiped out.
Tell the court why it was wiped out, because of the use you could put the information to, or because it was possible you'd have to give back the notes and copies, or all of that?
Both of those things, and even before you get to that, the court's interpretation of reasonable access means that the managers have discretion to withhold any documents in the first place. Before you even get to the point of copying, before you even get to the point of inspecting them, before you even get to the point of taking notes, it's a wide open, open-ended discretion in the manager's judgment to just withhold whatever the managers want to withhold. And bear in mind, this is a case where NAMA is seeking to enforce its inspection right, its contractual inspection right, for the purpose of investigating mismanagement by these managers. NAMA goes in to investigate mismanagement by these managers under a contract provision that should give it transparency into the business, and the managers themselves now have discretion to say, I'm sorry, in our discretion you get nothing.
But all of that is subject to judicial review, right?
Well, the court has put that all under the context of this interpretation of the agreement. Under the court's interpretation, reasonable access took on such a life that it granted the managers discretion to withhold documents which, in their judgment, apparently, they view as harmful to disclose without any standards or parameters or anything put on that. And under that rubric, as we sit here today, we have nothing, and we're 18 months or nearly 18 months since we made a demand. That was not the contractual scheme the parties bargained for. That's a contractual scheme they could easily have bargained for. Section 18305 of the LLC Act, in subsection 3, includes such a provision that gives the manager's discretion. The parties could have put that kind of a provision in their agreement, and they didn't. It's absent on that term, and that's compelling evidence the parties never intended the managers to have that kind of discretion and power over these documents. NAMA was supposed to have.
Somebody has to decide initially what's reasonable, subject to later judicial review, don't they?
I don't think so. Not under this contract, and here's why. NAMA is supposed to have access to the same extent on the same terms and conditions as the members. And when you look at the two sections that govern the members' access, sections 9.1 and 9.2, they have no limitations. No power is granted in the managers to withhold documents. It says the members shall have access in 9.2 to inspect and copy all of the documents, not some, all of the documents listed in 9.1. You go to 9.1 and they're listed. That's exactly what NAMA wants. That's exactly what NAMA's entitled to. And there's no room in there for the managers to make judgments about, well, this is reasonable to give you and this isn't. The parties bargained to get a list that's in 9.1 of everything described in 9.1, and that's what we should get.
Let me go back to the confidentiality issue. I don't see anything in the trial court's decision that really discusses or considers the extent of any confidentiality agreement. It seems that the trial court is saying it was reasonable to impose a confidentiality requirement on the disclosure of these books and records, and that your client said, no, we shouldn't have to sign one, and that was that. And the court said, yeah, you do have to be subject to confidentiality. But what I hear you saying, at least in part, on appeal, is that, yes, we would have signed a confidentiality agreement. Theirs was way too strict and was, almost preclusive. Was that fairly presented to the trial court or not?
Well, the trial court, it's this an odd part of the decision. Somewhat confusing, frankly, to us. The trial court in September, before it issued the judgment, issued a ruling that said the confidentiality agreement is not a part of my order and was not a part of my opinion. And therefore, on that basis, declined to rule on all of the objections that we had to that order. The judgment is then signed over our objection, saying that this form of confidentiality agreement is appropriate. In effect, in direct contradiction to the previous ruling that the confidentiality agreement isn't part of the ruling, it isn't part of the order, suddenly the confidentiality agreement is now part of the judgment and deemed to be appropriate without our objections having been ruled on. So we don't think this agreement should have been part of the judgment, since it wasn't considered and it wasn't. The court didn't rule on our objections, including the objections that we're talking about in the appeal. But at the same time, we face a judgment where it has been deemed to be appropriate.
Thank you.
Thank you. You've got about 2 minutes and 20 seconds left.
I'll hold that for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, Alan Terrell for appellee. At the table, I'd like to introduce Meredith Stewart from my office and Les Corwin from the Greenberg Proudreed firm. Before I turn to the substance that I plan to address, let me take a moment to correct the record that has been offered by my friend, Mr. Cohen. I think in response to Justice Berger's question about the confidentiality, he was referred to the lower court's opinion at page 8, footnote 9, with respect to the statement that the proposed confidentiality order presented by Venture was never negotiated by the appellant, and no proposed counter-confidentiality order was offered. The record was very clear on that. The trial courts cited the trial transcript. It's in the appendix at page 150. And if you were to turn to Joint Exhibit 6, you'll see that Mr. Cohen himself authored the letter of November 10, 2006, which letter rejects the confidentiality agreement that is being proposed by Venture. And if you were further to turn to Joint Exhibit 32, the letter dated April 2, 2007 from my friend Mr. Norman on behalf of the appellant, you'll see that apparently NAMA continued to resist any confidentiality order and taken the position that it wouldn't enter into the one that was being proffered by Venture. So the court's finding and conclusion that with respect to confidentiality, the position taken by the appellant is simply that no confidentiality order can be imposed. And that is, we believe, incorrect.
Well, let's suppose Mr. Cohen's client comes forward and says, we'll sign your confidentiality agreement today. Are they entitled to get everything listed in 9.1?
No. It doesn't follow that they're entitled to get everything in 9.1. It does indicate that with respect to 9.1, that's the scope of the documents that can be made available to members, and that with respect to their rights as third-party beneficiaries under Section 12.18 of the Venture Operating Agreement, it indicates they have the right, and it's subject to this reasonable access language, to see such books under 9.1.
Well, if I'm looking at page 21 of the Vice Chancellor's opinion, and he says, for the foregoing reasons, I'm interpreting 12.18E, and Venture has the power to impose reasonable terms and conditions on NAMA's right to inspect the documents listed in 9.1.
Correct.
Now, one way to read that is, i.e., a confidentiality agreement. And that's why my question was limited. But there seems to be a suggestion that even if a document is listed or covered by 9.1, there could be a management decision that you don't get it anyway, and that's reasonable. Is that your position?
We've not taken a position like that, Your Honor, because that issue did not arise in this case.
So, and as Justice Ridgely said, if that did come up, a court could resolve whether someone was entitled to it.
That's correct. Justice Ridgely quite properly pointed, I believe, to someone had had the power to manage this venture, this rather large and very complex venture, and the operating agreement provided that they were entities to do that. They were called the defined term managing members, and they have a great deal of discretion and authority in how they manage it that is set forth in Section 5.1 of the agreement, which the lower court acknowledged. So, Your Honor,
but just so I can focus on where we are in this case, it comes down to reasonable terms in your client's view, meaning we can require a confidentiality agreement. The Vice Chancellor said your agreement seemed satisfactory to him, and in the absence of an alternative proposal or even acknowledging that confidentiality could be required, that was his ruling.
Yes, Your Honor. I would like to just perhaps give you what I believe still is in the record by virtue of the appendix. Mr. Cohen is correct that following the issuance of the opinion, we turn to the confidentiality order because the opinion did hold that inspection would be permitted subject to reasonable conditions, and my client had proposed a confidentiality order. Rather than address the substance of that confidentiality order in detail in the opinion, he asked for the parties to submit on that. We submitted our confidentiality order. The appellant submitted its objections to the confidentiality order, and the court adopted ours to some extent. Of course, it did permit in that confidentiality order a copying, which initially was something that we had felt was inappropriate. So the court did weigh, if you will, the presentations by both parties on the actual confidentiality order. And I think what comes through in that exchange, Your Honor, is the significance of the appellant's objection to confidentiality order, which is simply that they wanted the unlimited right to use in any way the information that they might obtain from such inspection. And because of the nature of this project and the prior history with the appellant and some of the statements the appellants had made during the course of negotiations, the managing members were reluctant in any way to provide unlimited access or use of those documents, and that was consistent with the lower court's finding that there was a threat to venture if there wasn't some reasonable restrictions. I'm happy to address questions. I know Your Honors have already demonstrated a great familiarity with the case and the law, so let me just perhaps step back and say that if there's any doubt, there really is only, in this case, two interesting issues presented by this appeal, and that is, one, whether as a matter of straight contract interpretation, the term reasonable access is, as the appellants argue, synonymous with unlimited access, no conditions. We found that the Vice Chancellor's opinion is quite persuasive on that, and is consistent with our view that no, reasonable has to be given some meaning, and in light of all the other terms and provisions in this agreement, it makes sense that some conditions could be imposed. That then goes to the second issue then on appeal, namely whether or not those conditions that were in fact imposed were reasonable. And while as to the first question, Your Honors have, of course, de novo review responsibility, as to the second, I believe the standard of review is that you would only reverse in the event there were clear error by the court below. And as the opinion explains, the court below heard evidence at trial from the competing witnesses and received a great deal of documents and understood the competitive nature of this business and the relationships with the parties. And thus, when the court below found that, with one exception, the conditions were reasonable, we submit that finding was fully consistent with the evidence and should not be reversed. with respect to the two remaining issues, confidentiality and copying, I think they've been subsumed by the discussion we've had already today. Within the confidentiality order now approved by the court, there are copying rights to the appellant. And as the court weighed all the other terms and conditions, it did find that one of them imposed, namely the restriction on using an agent to make the inspection, was a condition he did not find reasonable. So I think it does represent a very thoughtful and balanced evaluation of the record in this case, and I submit that it should be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Very briefly, since I have 2 minutes, the confidentiality order is in the record. It's absolutely clear that we offered one, and it's absolutely clear what its terms are, and again, that's at 566. And the letter that accompanied it couldn't have made it any clearer at page 566 that we were willing to enter into that confidentiality agreement. Number two, there's been mention of a threat, and that somehow this threat of disclosure justified what the trial court did. It's important that the court take a very close look at exactly what that threat was and what it wasn't. That threat, the entire evidence for that threat, appears in the testimony of Sean Sampson. And exactly what he said is, NAMA threatened to sell its interest in Alliance Network and thereby disclose information to the buyer. NAMA threatened to sell its interest. If you look at the agreement itself, Section 19B of the Alliance Amendment, which is at 642 of the record, the agreement itself explicitly recognizes NAMA's right to sell its interest to a project competitor. So the circumstance that NAMA, quote unquote, threatened to sell its interest to a project competitor is exactly a circumstance that the agreements provided for and already recognized. And despite that possibility, the agreements do not provide any extra layers of confidentiality, and they certainly don't allow that excuse to be used to eviscerate the inspection right in its entirety. There's nothing unusual about that circumstance. That threat was nothing more than a threat to do exactly what the agreement at A642 to 643 contemplates NAMA could do. So that supposed threat could not possibly be used as an excuse to eviscerate the inspection right contained in the very same agreements. With that, we'll submit.
Thank you. Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement and will also take a brief recess.
Rise.